Those of you who know me know that I think that laughter is holy and healing, and so we're going to start with something funny today. I heard about these two baseball players who were good friends, but there was one thing they couldn't agree on, and that was whether or not there was professional baseball in heaven. And they argued about it their whole lives, and they decided, they came to an agreement. They said, okay, well, whoever dies first will come back and tell the other one whether or not there's baseball in heaven. So sure enough, one of the players died, and that night, the other player woke up, and sure enough, his friend was back, and his friend said, okay, I've got good news and bad news. And the first player said, okay, what is it? And the other guy says, well, the good news is there's baseball in heaven. The bad news is you're scheduled to pitch next Thursday. Baseball in heaven? Sounds like a good deal. May these words be to God's glory. I woke up at 6:30 in the morning on a couch in a darkened basement just outside of D.C. I'd gotten in at 2 a.m. the night before because the inauguration had clogged up the airways. I didn't sleep much anyway. I was too excited. The four of us, a part-time pastor, a political professional, a soldier, and a gay voice teacher, took the subway from the last stop into the city. You thought it was a joke, didn't you? No. That's the four of us. The chanting started on the escalator to the platform after the gate attendant, seeing that there were so many people that we couldn't possibly all purchase subway cards in anything resembling a timely fashion, just opened the turnstiles and let us through, and 60 women went, yay! There were so many people, not just women, but men too, that we all had to crowd into the train as tightly as possible. We were at the last possible stop on the line, but there were so many of us that we passed through the next two stops completely because there was simply no hope of anyone else getting on. Behind me, there were two men with heavy North Carolina accents. I was so happy to see them there, standing up for the women in their lives. One of them had a pit bull shirt on, not the artist, an actual pit bull. He stood back to back with his friend who was making space, kind of like this, for an adolescent girl in a pink hat with the ears, who is seated with what looked like her mother. The two women were giggling excitedly and arranging their signs. There was a lot of glitter, let me tell you. Glitter everywhere that day. We eventually did stop, though, and the doors opened. The car got more crowded. People pressed in on each other, and the jovial mood lessened as we all got kind of hot. The guy in the pit bull shirt, when the train rocked, brushed up against me in a way that every woman knows. Is he doing this on purpose, or is he just not bothering to back up? I asked my soldier friend to switch places with me, and of course, the guy stayed well out of his space. By the time we got close to the city, everyone was kind of tense and tired. It had been almost an hour, and we were eager to get off the train and start marching. The doors opened in an underground station, and they were open for a really long time. We just kind of sat there. And soon, a subway attendant called through the open door to the pitbull guy's friend. She said, "Sir, I need you to move in." I looked back at him, and he had his arms spread like this, leaning against the people behind him, physically leaning, so that his family, who was seated, could have space at the side of the car. There must have been 5 feet between him and his family. It had to have been the most room on the whole train. "There's no more room!" the man shouted. Everyone turned. This was the first raised voice we had heard, other than the chanting, and we were instantly nervous. It suddenly struck me that if anyone started a fight, I had nowhere to go. The subway attendant looked at the 5 feet of space he was creating in front of his family and said, "Sir, there is room. There, you need to move in." "I ain't moving in," he yelled. "I got kids back here. You want me to crush these kids?" "No, sir," she said, "but there are a lot of people out here who want to ride the train. Move in, please." "I ain't crushing no kids. You want me to crush these kids? Close the doors. Move on." I thought about his friend pressing against me as I looked at the open air in front of the teen girl. Space didn't seem to be a concern there. "Roll on," he shouted. "Roll on." I turned away, wanting to say something, but not wanting to make a scene I couldn't escape. "I ain't crushing no kids today," he said once more, his voice raised for the whole car to hear. It's funny how when we have space or resources or something we feel we need to protect, and we feel like those things are threatened even a tiny bit, our defensiveness is immediate and almost out of control in its force. We immediately go to the worst-case scenario to justify our defensiveness. No one was asking that man to crush kids. Who would say that? No one was getting crushed. In fact, in a march of between 3 and 5 million people worldwide, to my knowledge, not a single person was trampled or injured. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I didn't hear anything like that. And his daughter was old enough to defend herself. She wasn't a child. But when threatened, the man, like many of us, went right to the life or death conclusion and shouted it again and again until he was left alone. On Friday, Donald Trump signed an executive order banning immigration from Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen for 90 days and banning the entrance of Syrian refugees indefinitely. These countries are predominantly Muslim and poor, unlike Saudi Arabia and Egypt, which are also predominantly Muslim. And according to the Washington Post, the text of the order explained that this action was meant to combat terrorism. Terrorists. There's the worst case scenario for Americans, many Americans, and the worst possible version of a Muslim. Now, I know I don't need to say this, but I will anyway. The vast majority of Muslims are not terrorists. But a large swath of the country either doesn't care about this or doesn't know it or doesn't believe it. Many would rather close our borders to all Muslims than risk the possibility of a terrorist coming into the U.S. Never mind that, according to Time magazine, since 9/11, white right-wing Americans have committed twice as many acts of terrorism, if you define terrorism as the killing of many innocent people by violent means, as radical Islamists. Again, if you want to speak with me about sources afterwards, or if you wonder where I'm getting this, please, I will not be insulted. Come ask. Why do we go right to the worst-case scenario when we feel threatened? Why do we say the terrorists are coming and then go against the very words written on the statue many of our own ancestors passed when they arrived on boats? Give me, you're tired, you're poor. Well, for one thing, it works. It scares us enough that we close ranks and borders. We get our defenses up. We yell at strangers and make everyone so uncomfortable that they just drop it and we get to keep our resources. But the other one, and this one is perhaps even more powerful, is that tribalism is as old as the human race. We see the other and we get scared, especially if we already feel as though our position is precarious. According to late anthropologist John W. Burton, around the time that human evolved into bipeds, meaning we stood up from four legs to two, we began needing to live in groups to survive. We could no longer live alone. We needed someone to gather food, someone to prepare it, someone to keep the group safe, and so on. As time has gone on, our brains have evolved no longer in tandem with the physical demands of survival, but with our ability to fit into and get along in whatever social environment we find ourselves. Our ability to survive is literally contingent upon how like our peers we are. With this newfound communal life came the need to recognize threats to our resources, especially other groups of humans. Those who did not fit in, the other, were interpreted not just as potential competitors, but as fundamentally bad because they were not like us. Thus, everything from high school cliques to the artificial boundaries of race can arguably be traced back to our biological desire to survive. But the world is smaller now, right? We travel, we intermarry, and with the advents of airplanes and the internets, there is less and less we can say we've never heard of. It's also more militarized. Gunpowder and satellites and the atom bomb have made it possible to exterminate huge groups of people with just the press of a button. Our prejudices no longer amount to killing a stranger on the plains with a rock. They result in the deaths of millions of people, like Hiroshima or the Holocaust or the extermination of Native Americans or the war in Afghanistan, the second longest war in American history. The Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, is full of violent tribalism. After they leave Egypt, the Lord tells the people to kill the Canaanites, the Midianites, the men, women, and children of Sihon. They acquire their land, in Old Testament parlance, the Lord gives it to them, via military conquest. They run around for thousands of years killing and enslaving anyone who is different from them. However, the Old Testament is also full of injunctions to welcome the stranger, because the Israelites themselves were once strangers in the land of Egypt. Leviticus, the same book with the oft-cited injunction against homosexuality, reads, "The alien resides with you in your land, and you shall not oppress the alien. The alien who resides with you shall be to you as the citizen among you. You shall love the alien as yourself." The oldest refugee resettlement group in the world, HIAS, is Jewish and has helped hundreds of thousands of God's most vulnerable people in their times of need, welcoming them into their homes and advocating for their rights everywhere. And that's because that's what God literally asks of us, to be emissaries of justice and kindness in the world. We see it in today's scripture. What does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Doing justice, speaking up against policies which allow discrimination, poverty, and suffering to flourish. Loving kindness. How can we see those pictures of Syrian children bloodied and dusty and say, "Sorry, you might grow up to be a terrorist," and then turn them away? To walk humbly with our God. Don't we have enough space here in the train car of America? Maybe it doesn't feel that way in California, but relatively speaking, we do. Don't we have enough to share? And even if we feel threatened, as so many of us do, say if we can't afford housing or we can't afford health insurance, can we not understand that those who are fleeing war-torn countries are not the problem, but our own prejudices and greed that have constructed the system designed to amass wealth for a few while excluding most? That's the enemy. So who needs to change if we want to stop the pain? But it is hard, right? We're naturally tribal people. And when we feel threatened, and who doesn't feel sort of on edge these days, but perhaps not for the reasons we think, we start yelling, we manspread, we go right to the most dire consequence, and we scare ourselves out of compassion. But the church, Jesus' message, was made for times like these. I'm sure he didn't think of it this way, but his ministry is the ultimate in communal survival techniques. Jesus' world was getting smaller too, and his religious tradition was keeping out the other. It was, according to him, obsessed with keeping out the other, and that was missing the point of the whole God thing. But maybe Jesus realized that the human race can't survive on exclusion, resource hoarding, and arbitrary rules based on fear. Maybe he knew that we're all one tribe, and that we need a new way of looking at ourselves that isn't so paranoid if the human race is going to thrive. So, he urged us to see the wretched as blessed. Sometimes this has been used as an excuse for suffering, these verses about blessed are the poor in spirit, but I don't think that's a productive use of these verses. I think they're about hope, that suffering ends, that when we suffer, we will be redeemed. Or to today's subject, blessed are the refugees whose own countrymen kill them. Blessed are the poor across the border, where law enforcement works not for the people, but for the cartels. And even if the suffering are not especially blessed, we know we're supposed to care for these folks, right? My friend Adam, who teaches at Eden Theological Seminary, posted on his Facebook wall, "For I was hungry, and you said, 'Keep those criminals out, build a wall.' I was thirsty, and you said, 'Oil for us is more important than water for them. Build the pipeline.' I was a stranger, and you said, 'He could be a terrorist. Don't let him in.' I was sick, and you said, 'Take away our health insurance.' I was in prison, and you said, 'Those people disgust me. We should bring back the death penalty.' Truly, I tell you, whatever you did to one of the least of these, you did to me. God does not want burnt offerings with calves a year old or thousands of rams with 10,000 rivers of oil. God doesn't want wealth, and wealth does not make us holy, contrary to a particular American mythos which says the richer you are, the closer to God you must be. God wants us to do something that is harder. Welcome those who are different from us." Now, it made my heart light to read, as I was writing this sermon, that already the executive order keeping immigrants and refugees out is meeting with significant resistance. According to CNN, a federal judge in New York granted an emergency stay, quote, "for citizens of 7 Muslim-majority countries who have already arrived in the U.S. and those who are in transit and who hold visas, ruling they cannot be removed from the U.S. If you look up this order online, it's amazing. It's the name of two citizens versus the President of the United States. It's so neat to see that we live in a country where we get to say to the President directly, no, we are not okay with this. For all the flaws we have, that is a good thing. The ACLU, ever on the forefront, is arguing, as I write this sermon yesterday, for a nationwide stay that would block the deportation of all people stranded in U.S. airports. And better still, religious organizations are up in arms because we all know what we've been asked to do by God with the alien, and banning them from coming here isn't it. Mark Hetfield, president of HIAS, was quoted on NPR as saying, the faith groups are going to kick and scream and object to every aspect of this disgusting, vile executive order. It makes America out to be something we are not. We are a country that welcomes refugees. The Interfaith Immigration Coalition has reopened a 2016 petition in opposition to the Muslim ban, and it's been signed by hundreds of faith leaders. Reverend Steve Martin, communications director for the National Council of Christians, said, I can't even believe that things are getting like this, that state-sponsored persecution of a class of people is happening. We explicitly condemn any religious test for refugees. This is a high-ranking Christian getting out and saying these things. From the Huffington Post, quote, a letter drafted by Christian aid organization Church World Service, those guys are huge, and signed by more than 2,000 faith leaders, called on the Trump administration and members of Congress to, quote, demonstrate moral leadership and affirm their support for the resettlement of refugees from all over the world to the United States. Wow, they asked him to be a bigger person and let in the needy. It kind of makes you proud to be a person of faith, doesn't it? I know it's hard not to feel overwhelmed and helpless when it seems like injustice is everywhere. We heard that today when we were praying. And each week, something new and awful seems to happen. But we get to come here every Sunday and get renewed. We get to get filled up so we can do this work in the world. So what can we do, right, other than praying and hoping? Posting our outrage on Twitter feels good, makes me feel super important, but it doesn't actually help anyone. On the back table, there are sheets of paper with instructions for calling your congressperson. Now, this seems like a small thing, but it's not. We've elected these folks. Their duty is to us. And frankly, other people who loudly call themselves Christians are much better at making themselves heard politically than we are, so we need to do something different. And even if it does seem small, nothing is small if it's done for the greater good. What's that saying? We can do no great things, only small things with great love. That's a small thing you can do with great love. And if calling a stranger on the phone is not small to you, I know it's intimidating for many of us, don't worry, I've included an actual script you can use. You can literally call, read, and hang up. Because living in this country is a blessing. All this space we've carved out on a crowded planet is useless if we can't share it with those who need it. Think of the last time you helped someone. You gave them something they really needed. Wasn't it amazing? It feels good to help. You know that feeling when it costs you nothing, but it means everything to them? How lucky are we that we live in a country that people spend their life savings and risk their lives to emigrate to? Now, I know things aren't perfect. In fact, I just got word that Les and I will be in the housing market unexpectedly again in April. Hooray, we have to rent again. We're not leaving, but it's like, ugh, geez, again. But there's a verse in Matthew that always reminds me what we're called to do. It goes, is there anyone among you who, if your child asks for bread, will give a stone? Or if the child asks for a fish, will give a snake? If you then, who are imperfect, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will God give good things to those who ask? God has given many of us bread and fish and plenty, and we have an opportunity to, in turn, give Syrian children bread instead of rubble. We can open our borders to the tired, the poor, the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And yes, resources have limits. Refugees are not the only people on the planet who are struggling. But what causes problems in the United States isn't a lack of resources. It's the hoarding of those who are afraid to lose. The people on the train who feel the press of the crowd at their backs and go right to, my kids will die if three more people get on. Out of God's abundance, we have received abundantly. Jesus asked us to evolve, to be one human race, which welcomes the other with open arms. God willing, as Christians, we can help make that happen. Amen.